Our show today was taped in front of a live audience in Philadelphia, one of the great food cities of America, at WHYY. And we made the trip to learn what makes the Philly food scene so awesome. So we pulled together three of the city's most influential chefs: Zahav's Mike Solomonov, Angie Branca from Sauté Campar, and our next guest, Eli Culp. So Eli was new to Philadelphia when his chef career really took off. Like, within 2 years, he was named a Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine, and Bon Appetit called his high street the second hottest restaurant in the country, and he was ready to open a new place, 2 hours away in New York. But commuting home one night, the train he was on took a sharp turn at 100 miles an hour, and after that accident, Eli travels in a wheelchair and works to reinvent himself as a chef who no longer cooks in his kitchen. Here he is joining me on stage.
I don't know if you heard the clacking as Eli's wheelchair was coming up the ramp, but we were saying before, it's like, you're going on a roller coaster.
That's exactly.
So Eli, I actually know from New York City. Your last job before moving to Philadelphia was as the chef at truly one of the greatest restaurants I've ever been to. It's called Terrizzi Italian Specialties. And if you don't know it, it was sort of talked about in the press a little bit as, the food was sort of described as being like, you know, fancied up Italian-American food. But I don't think that was exactly right. It had a lot of Italian-American signifiers. There was mozzarella. There was a portrait of Billy Joel and his, who's not Italian, but, you know, right. Everyone loves that guy. But there's, like, boxing gloves, and there were, like Stella D'Oro breadsticks on the wall, and it was in this tiny little deli.
But about 450 square feet.
It was the size of this stage. And, but what I was so amazed by, the food you were making there, was it really, this idea of Italian-American food, and people think, well, that means chicken parmesan, and it means, you know, all these stereotypical dishes, but what was amazing to me was it showed that side of itself. But to me, it always felt like the inspiration was about the American part of Italian-American. And it was a restaurant that really took its inspiration from America and the neighborhood it was in. It was in this neighborhood of Nolita, which is north of Little Italy, but very close to Chinatown and the Lower East Side, which was an incredible historic center of immigration in New York City, like waves and waves of Irish and German and Jewish immigrants from mm-hmm. Eastern Europe and Chinese and Dominican and communities have all sort of come through the Lower East Side. And so the dishes at Terrizzi were things like a salad of cucumbers that was, I think, fresh cucumbers, and then like quarter sour pickles and half sour pickles and full sour pickles with a coriander vinaigrette. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I'm eating a Jewish pickle barrel.
Yeah.
Or I remember there was a cavatelli with like a spicy beef ragu, and there was a little bit of like maybe turmeric in the cavatelli, and I'm eating it, and it's, you know, an Italian dish, it's pasta, but I'm eating it and I thought, oh my God, this is a Jamaican beef patty.
Yep.
And so the food was brilliant because you would go and you would have all these references to these other neighborhoods in the city. Clearly you had taken so much inspiration and research and kept filtering them through this other lens. So it was a little bit like of a trompe-l'oeil effect. So you moved here to Philadelphia to become the chef of Fork Restaurant.
Yeah.
Did you take that same mentality and when you were cooking here, and what inspiration did you find when you got here? What were you making?
Yeah, so, you know, being a part of Terrizzi for those 2 years before I came down here was probably the most formative years as far as learning how to take a thought, giving it some sort of background, and then putting it on a plate. Mm-hmm. First thing I did when I got the job here in Philly was to just search you know, what is Philadelphian cuisine? Because of course you have, soft pretzels, and you have, cheese steaks, and you have the whoopie pies, and I started looking, I started digging deeper, and I saw things that were really special, and started to think about how I could take this same spectrum that we were looking through at the food at Terese and applying it to Philadelphia.
Right.
You know, as I discovered more and more spending time down here, I think the main thing was just the amazing proximity to very passionate, very dedicated farmers and farm systems. You know, whether it was a technique, taking a really great potato and taking the soil from that farm, putting aromatics with the soil, like, cinnamon and garlic and ginger and cooking the potatoes in the dirt that came from the farm. That would be another idea that came because the farmers are coming into your kitchen. You're able to talk with them directly.
Yeah.
In New York, you would sort of have to go to the market on either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Saturday, fight the crowds. If you can help it, try not to spend $10 on a cab, what I mean? Getting it back to the restaurant. And, I realize here in Philadelphia, the relationship with the farmers and the farms was so much closer than what it was in New York.
Yeah.
And that was really an inspiration because then they started bringing me their ideas. What if I leave this product in the ground over the winter? What is that going to do to the parsnip? What's that going to do to the treviso? These really amazing ideas would come out of these relationships with the farmers.
Yeah. So you had tremendous success quickly upon arrival. Within, I think, 2 years, you had opened High Street, which is fabulous. It was named a Bon Appetit Best New Restaurant, and you had plans to open a High Street in New York. You're on the rise in a tremendous way in terms of your career trajectory. You suffer a tremendous accident, and now you're in the mode of going from, an ascending empire builder to having to think about whether or not you'll ever stand in the kitchen and cook again. You've spent a lot of time healing physically, emotionally, mentally, thinking a lot about what it now means to be a chef who doesn't have use of his body in the same way. But I also read an interview with you that said, you really struggled in a serious way, and I'm sure some days are still like that. But that in November of 2016, you felt like you had a bit of a switch. Mm-hmm. What was that switch?
You know what? That was about 18 months after the accident. It's 6 months of rehab, inpatient rehab, from Philadelphia to New York to Atlanta, trying to put yourself in the best position to recover the best you possibly can. The acute stress that you're under in those first 6 months is not just me, but my family and everything else goes around with it was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. I remember when I first got back to New York, we had signed, just rewind a little bit here, but we signed the lease for the New York restaurant in March of 2015. I got hurt 2.5 months later. Mm-hmm. So the restaurant was just starting the process of the construction and all that. Getting back to New York and this dream of mine, which was to have this restaurant in New York, I was very excited about it. I really saw the company going. And then when I got back, what it represented to me was loss now, because it was one thing, I was working like crazy. I was going back and forth, and I felt like my job almost killed me, literally. And, the 18 months after getting hurt, it's really just about figuring out life again. You have to figure out how to do everything again, how you're going to live, how you're going to survive, just getting everything lined up, rehab, you know, 3-4 days a week. You really don't have time to focus on anything but that.
Sure.
It was about 18 months after when, you know, something clicked in me. I don't know what was the real impetus for it, but I knew at that point I had to stop feeling sorry for myself. I really had to figure out how to get back in the mix and really how to survive on my own and try to make the most of it. When you have my son was 3.5 at the time, but you know, this kid, he's not going to wait around for you, you know? And I think that was probably, you know, the one thing that in me, I had to come to grasp with that and say, okay, I need to, it's not going to be what I thought it was going to be, but I can make the most out of it. And then getting back in the kitchen a little more, forcing myself back into the public, and a ton of therapy as well to go along with that. But,
sure.
You know, getting back into it, was important. And you know, I feel like I'm succeeding in that now. So
in what ways are you a better chef now than you were before your accident?
I think, you know, you have to adjust, you have to evolve. And obviously being in the kitchen day in and day out, you know, is not going to happen. It's not going to be like it was. As far as being better, it's hard to say exactly what I'm better at. I think for me, I have to be able to teach, explain, talk about food in a different way so that if I have an idea in my head of a dish or we're talking about something, I have to be very careful. I'm learning about ways to describe that dish so that it is as close as I can get it to how I see it and I taste it in my head. Which, you know, some successes, some not. So it's always a learning process.
Sure. It's interesting because I was reading, you know, your old colleague, Rich Terese, who said, you know, Eli's this huge dude. And he said that you could always feel how he could sense his own presence in a room. And I think that that's such a tremendously powerful thing when you have an awareness, not just of yourself, but how your presence in a room influences a dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to be a great communicator, it's about making connections, and making connections is about empathy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's about recognizing what your presence does to and with the other people that you're talking to.
Absolutely.
So I think in his saying that, I thought what you're describing, a focus now on communication rather than doing and having you see me do this thing and let me show you this thing, but let me talk with you.
Yeah.
Let me mentor you. It sounds like that's a thing that you can do, right? That's a thing that is a strength and a power of yours.
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, that's something that I still take a lot of pride in.
Yeah.
You know, I always ran my kitchens, you know, I use the analogy of a good sports team. You know, everybody has their role. Everybody has their job to do. And if everybody does that, we succeed together. And that's no different now. And, you know, for me to suggest that, you know, the satisfaction is the same, I think that would be, that wouldn't be genuine. I think there's still a lot of what was that I miss every day.
Sure.
And it's not, you know, by no means is it something that, I don't think anything will ever take that place. It's just about how I fill up the rest of the, you know, the time with other, inspirations and trying to, you know, those things are going to give my life the purpose that I had with food, being in the kitchen, leading the team to battle every day. You know, those are the areas where I'm now working on filling those in other ways.
Thank you so much, Chef.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eli Culp.
Thank you, Eli.
Eli Culp is the chef partner of Fork, and High Street on Market.